the debate.
And welcome to Debate. I'm Marcia Hashimi. Appreciate you being with us. It is not likely that any of the top brass of the Saudi Arabia at the start of their onslaught on Yemen thought that 6.5 years later they would still be fighting. And now it is the Yemeni military along with Ansarullah fighters who are now attacking Saudi Arabia. Yemeni army spokesman announced that Yemen had initiated retaliatory attacks inside of Saudi Arabia on the King Khalid military base in Nasser. Stay with us as we take a look at how the tables have turned on the Saudi regime.
The Yemeni army has carried out another successful massive operation that was announced by the spokesman for the Yemeni army, Yahya Sariya, who described the offensive as a major victory in the southern Saudi Jazan region.
There is no doubt that this operation will affect the Saudi enemy severely, especially as it comes at a time when the Marib fronts and other fronts are under much pressure. Thus, these back-to-back victories confirm Saudi Arabia's inability to achieve any of the goals declared at the beginning of the war. The Saudi-led coalition failed in the military confrontation, while the Yemeni army continued to significantly improve its capabilities.
The spokesman stated that this operation comes in response to the escalation of Saudi Arabia's war and its ongoing siege on Yemen. Military experts said this victory could be part of the ongoing talks as it will push Riyadh further to accept a fair political solution.
Every military operation, including the Jizan operation, has political dimensions. Saudi Arabia is an arrogant country that believes its capabilities and the support it receives by Britain and America will help it achieve something in the field. Today, the Yemeni army proved that it is capable of gaining military control and that the battle has moved deep inside Saudi soil. Saudi Arabia is forced to move forward a political solution, but militarily it has completely failed.
Earlier, Yemen's armed forces carried out a retaliatory attack against the King Khalid Air Base in Azir using Qassam K2 drones. The Saudi war has brought about the world's worst humanitarian crisis in Yemen, according to the United Nations.
Observers say the ongoing operation by the Yemeni army has sent a clear message to Saudi Arabia. That is, as long as the Saudi war and siege against Yemen is persist, Yemen's army will carry out more massive retaliatory attacks deep inside the kingdom. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
I'd like to welcome my guests to this program, Director of Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Zafar Bankash, out of Toronto, and Elijah Makian, journalist and political analyst out of Brussels. Thank you both for being with us. Well, let's start it off in Toronto. And Zafar, how could the Saudis have miscalculated Yemen this much? I mean, they thought the war would not take more than a month or two. Your assessment?
Well, basically, the Saudi defense minister, who is now also the crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, when he was first appointed, he was full of arrogance. He thought that the Saudi army, because it is equipped with a lot of weapons, would be able to wipe out any Yemeni resistance. But what he did not realize was, number one, that the Saudi army is not motivated. In fact, they are not really capable of fighting. Number two, they underestimated the Yemenis' resistance. The point is that the Yemenis are fighting for their land, for their honor, for their principle. What the Saudis are doing is they are the aggressors. They want to occupy somebody else's land, and they want to install a puppet regime in Yemen. Obviously, that is not acceptable to the Yemeni people. Secondly, the Saudis counted on a number of mercenaries. In fact, they approached a number of countries, including countries like Pakistan and Egypt and so on, hoping that they would send their armed forces to support the Saudis, and these countries refused. So the Saudis had to resort to mercenaries from South America, from Africa, from Sudan, etc. But naturally, even these mercenaries cannot continue to wage a war on behalf of the Saudis. So as you mentioned, it's been more than 6 years, And I think the Saudi army and their soldiers, etc., have realized that this is a lost cause, and the best thing is not to put up a fight. And in fact, many of them are surrendering.
Well, Elijah, the Saudis initiated a ruthless onslaught on Yemen back in 2015, bombing civilian areas and infrastructure, and also implementing a land, air, and sea siege of the area. I mean, what was Riyadh really trying to accomplish with this type of violence against the civilian population in Yemen?
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming.
There are 2 points. First of all, Saudis are trying to submit Yemen to its control because Yemen is considered its backyard. And secondly, they are afraid of the influence of Iran in Yemen. This is what the Saudis tried, started the war, thinking that it is a promenade, and thinking that in a matter of weeks this will end. It has been 6 years, and during these 6 years, the Yemeni learned how to make their own bombs, have learned the art of war, and they have also learned how to retaliate. And what we have seen very recently in the last 24 hours, how the Yemeni are taking the initiative and attacking Jazan and making really strong progress. Now, what Saudi Arabia is doing is really destroying Yemen. The cost of war so far is estimated around $100 billion. And the only thing that Saudis have achieved so far is the destruction of the country where there is the largest humanitarian crisis ever against the poorest country in the Middle East. We saw the Yemenis are learning how to fight back, how to make missiles, and how to do their own drones and armed drones, and how to retaliate and hurt Saudi Arabia. And I think now the Saudis are trying to find a way out, but they want to gain in negotiation what they failed to gain in the war.
Okay.
Therefore, the Houthis... Yes, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, let me just get Zafar back in on this discussion. Well, although the Yemenis have been under a Saudi siege, Yemeni fighters and Houthis have continually improved, so much so that they're now attacking Saudi Arabia. What do you attribute this to? I mean, how are they able to do this despite this siege?
Well, I think we need to keep in mind that the Yemenis are one people that have never, ever surrendered to the foreign forces. That goes to their credit. Secondly, as your guest pointed out, the Yemenis have been able to make immense progress in terms of developing their military capabilities. Yemen already had actually a missile industry before the Saudis launched a war against them, but it was not as advanced as it has come now. And thirdly, the Saudi army, they're not only totally incompetent, they're also demoralized. So what the Yemenis have been able to do is, because of their determination, because of the fact that their cause is just, they are fighting to defend their own land. They're not committing aggression. In fact, even the operations that they are carrying out inside Saudi Arabia in provinces like Jizan and Asir, these actually belong to the Yemeni people. These were illegally occupied by the Saudis in 1934. So perhaps this Saudi aggression against Yemen that was launched in March of 2015 may turn out to be a blessing in disguise for the Yemenis, despite the enormous sacrifices that they have had to make, but that they perhaps might be able to reclaim the land that the Saudis had illegally occupied back in 1934. So their cause is just, they are highly motivated, they are excellent fighters, they have never surrendered to any foreign forces. All of these factors actually go in favor of the Yemeni people. Mm.
Okay. Well, Elijah, I mean, how significant in your perspective that we've seen the Yemeni forces just attacking a military base by drone inside of Saudi Arabia, and we've seen other retaliatory attacks and dealing with oil tankers. How disruptive has this been?
I think that had significant effect on Saudi Arabia economy, reputation, and finance. We saw how the Yemeni were able to disrupt the oil flow from Saudi Arabia to the rest of the world for several days, and even for a couple of weeks, and we saw how the Yemeni were able to head inland in Saudi Arabia and to give back the same amount of, not the same amount, but to retaliate in Saudi Arabia, in different area, even going toward far in Saudi Arabia, so 1,200 kilometers. We saw how the Yemeni were capable to force the Saudis to the negotiation table. Unfortunately, the Americans are negotiating on behalf of the Saudis now in Sana'a, and not the Saudis, because they don't have the skills or the courage to negotiate.
Well, what about that, Vafai? Elia talked about the Americans negotiating on behalf of the Saudis. Your perspective on the United States, do you think that at this point in time that they want this war to end? Are you detecting some type of changing perspective coming out of Washington? How are your assessment overall?
Well, the Americans are actually trying to change the perception, but not their policy. So while Biden and his regime continues to talk about not providing offensive weapons to the Saudis, but we have seen no evidence that they have stopped supplying weapons to the Saudis, or that they are still providing logistical and intelligence support to the Saudis. So these negotiations that are taking place under UN auspices regarding Yemen, obviously, as Elijah pointed out, these are basically guided by the Americans, because America virtually controls the United Nations, and so it is actually dictating the agenda. But what is important and crucial for your viewers to understand is that the Yemenis, throughout this war on them, have maintained the high moral ground. The Saudis have been attacking civilian infrastructure. The Yemeni Ansarullah fighters have not attacked any civilian infrastructures. They have targeted military installations. They have targeted economic installations. There was only one instance, in fact, when the Yemenis fired a missile at a palace in which they thought the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman was staying. So throughout these 6+ years, the Yemenis have only targeted military installations because they do not believe in inflicting civilian casualties, although they can. So on these counts, I think the Yemenis really maintain the high moral ground, and they are fully justified in not accepting any demands that the Americans make of them.
Well, Elijah, what about Riyadh itself? Do you think it is looking for a way to end this war now?
Riyadh is really willing to come out of this problem that Saudi Arabia put itself in, and we cannot exclude the meeting, the couple of meetings that happened between Saudi Arabia and Iran in Baghdad, where the Saudis on the top of their agenda was the situation in Yemen. And we saw how Minister Zarif went to Muscat, Salam, to slow down on the base that the Saudis will lift the siege. And the Yemeni made it very clear, we cannot stop the war on our side because the Houthis are now dictating the battle. They said, we cannot stop the war on our side unless you lift the siege, and we will not accept an exchange of ceasefire in exchange of humanitarian aid. You allow us to survive. You allow us to live. We want the 16 ships that are full of oil. There is no oil in Yemen today, and we want all the aids before we start talking about a ceasefire. Today, Saudi Arabia is trembling of the idea that the Houthis are going to liberate Marib, and this is going to happen very soon. And I think they will liberate Marib and get their oil rich before accepting any ceasefire.
Okay. Well, Zafar, there seems to be a unique strength and determination in the Yemeni people. I mean, what is it that makes them so determined? Although the Saudi regime is killing civilians on a regular basis, as well as destroying the infrastructure, restricting basic necessities, and at least 16 million Yemenis are estimated to be food insecure out of a population of 29 million, and they have refused to surrender to the Saudi regime. And you touched on this a bit, but I'd like for you to expand on it.
Sure. Basically, as I mentioned, the Yemeni people are absolutely brilliant fighters. There are very few other people in the world, perhaps I might even mention the Afghans, who have defeated now the third superpower of their time. But the Yemenis are absolutely determined fighters. But what is also very crucial to keep in mind is that the Yemenis don't rely only on weapons, they rely on their faith. They have a firm conviction in God's help. They are very, very determined people. They are very pious people. As I mentioned, they have not targeted civilians in Saudi Arabia, although they are quite capable of doing it, which shows that they have maintained the high moral ground. They have maintained their dignity and their honor in the face of all of these extremely difficult conditions that have been imposed upon them. I mean, you know, a country that is under total siege, they cannot get food in, they cannot get oil in, and, you know, millions of people are starving. More than a million children are afflicted by cholera epidemic. I mean, this is absolutely unheard of in recent history. And yet, the Yemenis have maintained their dignity and honor because they have such strong commitment to Allah and to Islam, mm-hmm. and they want to maintain that, and that is the reason why they have been successful. And I think we should take heart from this fact that whenever Muslims, regardless of where they are, for instance, you can look at the situation in Palestine, in Gaza, again, the commitment of the people of Palestine and their firm commitment to Allah has provided them these opportunities. So I think this is a very important lesson for Muslims worldwide,
okay.
that instead of relying on weapons, they can rely on the help of Allah and remain steadfast.
But what about that, Elijah? You heard Zafar, he talked about Palestine. I want to look at this because something else unique about the Yemenis, at the despite all of the hardships that we've just mentioned, some of them, they've recently been raising money for the Palestinians after the situation that took place 11 days onslaught, Israeli onslaught on Gaza. They have been busy raising money and giving support to the Palestinian cause despite them being under such pressure. Now, both of these groups, it's interesting, if we look at the similarities of what's happening in Gaza and what's happening in Yemen, both under siege, and the resistance despite this pressure both being effective. Your take on this?
This is a very important question. Apart from the touching move of the Yemeni, who are really starving and have very little asset, they managed to put together over $200,000. I mean, look at the amount they managed to put together to send it to Gaza and to support the Palestinian population. This gest is very significant, but the most significant, we see how the axis of the resistance that goes from Yemen to Tehran, to Baghdad, to Syria, Damascus, and to Lebanon, and to end in Gaza, how it is all compact and it's holding together. When Yemen came out and said, we are waiting for Gaza to tell us if they need us to fight and to support them, this is extremely significant because that is the work of all these years to bring out a line of population ready to fight against the aggressor, whoever they are, wherever they are, whoever they are, because even if they are very strong, the people of Yemen express their solidarity with Gaza to tell them that you are not alone and this whole front is here to support you. The creation of this front is the most significant issue in all of this.
Zafar, your take on this resistance front and being in solidarity now, of course, had been before, but definitely seeming to be even more effective than it has been. Your assessment?
Absolutely. In fact, as we see these developments unfold, the resistance front is gaining more and more strength. And this clearly indicates that the resistance front, which obviously the Islamic Republic of Iran is a major component of, been motivated to a level whereby these resistance fighters are not guided by any worldly considerations, but in fact they are determined to uphold truth and justice, whether it is in Yemen, in Gaza, in Lebanon, in the rest of Palestine, in Iraq, where they are facing this American occupation, or in Syria, which again is has been subjected to the horrendous mercenary onslaught from all over the world, and of course with the American forces over there. But the fact that the Islamic Republic was upfront in supporting Syria, because Syria is a very, very important component for the resistance front in order to be able to provide material support to Hezbollah in Lebanon, as well as material support to the people of Gaza. So we see that the resistance front is actually operating on very high moral principles and upholding justice and fairness. And I think any people that stand up for truth and justice and show solidarity, I think ultimately they will triumph.
And Elijah, your take, now that not only the resistance front, but we look at Yemen itself, the military and Ansar Allah, the Houthis are getting stronger by the day. Do you see a light at the end of the tunnel as far as this war? Do you think that we're heading towards the end of the Saudi onslaught on Yemen?
Actually, I do, because today we see the axis of the resistance coming together, but we also see another element wherever there is an attack against one member of the axis of the resistance. The operational theater can be anywhere in these countries, and we're talking about Yemen, Iraq, Lebanon, Syria, and Gaza. And this solidarity is forcing the other side, who is fighting in these countries, particularly the United States, to stop this war, to try to do something to stop this solidarity that is already made, and nothing can stop it. Therefore, I think the Saudis are really seriously going toward the ceasefire, because they have lost the battle and they want to end it, come out with the less damage possible. Therefore, the negotiation that is happening in Muscat today, the Americans are trying to gain some ground, and the Houthis are very firm, and they will continue to do so. And I think it is an advantage of the Saudis and the Americans to end this war, and I think this is going to happen most probably this year.
All right, and on that note, appreciate both of you being with us for this debate. Zafar Bankash, Director of Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought out of Toronto, and Elijah McNear, journalist and political analyst out of Brussels. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, let there be light, and there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image, then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint. A critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. A warm welcome to the program, or to our audience, and welcome you to the program Viewpoint. In this series of the programs, we are going to criticize a couple of movies hovering around the topic or the subject of cloning. Basically, what I had in mind as the host of this program, wanted to focus on five movies, and we found five movies. But in each of these movies are going to get a couple of episodes, hopefully. And we're going to start with The Sixth Day. Well, along with me sitting are dear guests, Sayyid Abdullah. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the program.
Wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure being here.
And thank you very much. The pleasure is mine. And Brother Hussein. Assalamu alaikum. And welcome to the program.
Salam. Thank you.
Well, Brother Sayyid Abdullah, let me start with you with the movie The Sixth Day. In short, in the distant future, human cloning technology falls into the destructive, corrupt hands of a multinational corporation. I'm not going to name anything, right?
Yeah, okay.
Well, but one man refuses to be a pawn in this deadly conspiracy, all right? And the whole movie starts with a series of, like, newspaper flashes, and it talks about how cloning came into being, in fact, based on, like, first of all, they mapped the DNA of, like, some specific animals,
the
and
sheep.
Then the sheep, the sheep. And we can also listen to a biologist talking about Dolly the sheep.
Welcome to Moo Moo Math and Science. I'd like to talk about animal cloning, how they clone Dolly the sheep. Basically, in order to clone another animal, you take a cell from one, then you take an egg without a nucleus, and then basically you get an offspring. But it's a little bit more involved. Dolly was the first animal that was cloned, and Dolly was cloned almost 20 years ago. Here's what happened. Step one was to remove a cell from the udder of sheep number one. They then took this cell back to the laboratory and starved it in order to force it into an almost embryonic state. Next, they took an egg from another sheep, we'll call it sheep two, and removed the nucleus. Step three, they used electric shock and fused these two cells together. Step four, they implanted this fused cell into a female sheep. They actually fused more than 200 cells, and one developed into a full adult. Dolly had the same cells as the original udder cells. What did we learn from cloning Dolly? The main thing was that it helped advance stem cell research, and it proved that the nucleus of an adult cell had all the DNA to give rise to another animal. Dolly lived for 6 more years and then lived from a lung disease. Anyway, that's cloning 101.
Well, that was a biologist talking about Dolly the sheep. So based on the movie The Sixth Day, then the DNA is mapped, and then they succeeded in clone an animal in the whole being.
Yeah.
Right? We know that we have different kinds of cloning.
Yeah.
Like we have therapeutic cloning, we have gene cloning or DNA mapping and cloning, and we also have reproductive cloning.
Precisely.
All right. Do you have any comments here, first of all?
Well, for the movie or for the cloning process?
For the cloning process.
So the cloning process, like what you mentioned, you have a few types.
Yes.
So you have the pre-reproductive cloning and then you have the therapeutic cloning happening. The movie, though, it's neither of these two, though. They were trying.
What do you mean?
So the movie itself, The Sixth Day, it seems to be about cloning.
Yes.
But in fact, it's a different type of cloning altogether, where you have a human body stuck in a pool of water surrounded by a shell.
Yes.
And then they just put a programming into it, and then the body takes form, and then the information transferred, which is nonsensical in every sense of the
usually
word.
Usually media or the movie industry, in fact, gloss it over this way or another, you know?
No. See, so sometimes, like, even if you look at the reviews of that movie itself, whether it's Rotten Tomatoes or elsewhere,
yes,
the movie itself sucked big time, right? Uh-huh. Because even when you make a movie, when you produce a movie, you want to make it entertaining.
Yes.
At the same time,
mm-hmm.
it has to be entertaining from,
yes.
You know, that's something that you can... from a scientific perspective, you could go with it, right?
Yes, true.
So, I mean, we have other cloning movies, like you mentioned, which I've already seen.
Mm-hmm.
From scientifically, they could be digested and swallowed.
Yes.
But this one is absolutely out of the point. It's just ridiculous in every sense of the word, where you have a human body made outside the womb. I don't know how they would, they don't tell us. And then all of a sudden, they insert a disc inside the head, and then
yes.
or through a machine, and information transferred. That's not cloning.
Mm-hmm.
I could not find a word for it, so
yes.
you call it what you like, but it's definitely not cloning.
Yeah,
right.
You're right.
It's like I said, it's not entertaining, not scientific. It's not, because like I said, we watch movies, and some
yes,
movies,
true.
Even though we do understand that it's a scientific impossibility, but yet it's you know, it makes sense. In a way, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like I say, other movies also, they, you know, they bring a scientist and they talk about it, and they talk about the process they're making it. Well, that's what science fiction is, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you create a scenario from science fiction, and then, you know, it's more believable for the purpose of entertaining. But
something
this
digestible.
Yeah, digestible. This
yeah.
is not even digestible.
Yeah.
I could not put my hands on it. I mean, I couldn't understand what was the point of the movie to begin with, to be quite honest.
But you know, sometimes we are talking about future, and then you're talking about the womb and the egg cell, and then they take away the nucleus of, like, an asexual cell,
yeah.
even from a skin cell,
yeah.
and put it in the womb of a female, like, animal
yeah.
or
yeah.
even human being, and then to try to develop it there, right?
Okay.
But it can happen in a test tube, or it can happen in a lab or something like that,
so we
in the near future.
We have no
it
issue
can.
With that.
Uh-huh.
Well, that's not what the issue is.
Right.
Okay, so we're saying if you can, because this is the whole idea of cloning, right? For example, with Dolly, the sheep, they took
yes.
the DNA, they put it in another sheep's
mm-hmm.
womb, and then it developed.
Yes.
This is a pre-productive cloning.
Mm-hmm.
But to create an entire human being outside without a womb, that's not even impossible. That's just science fiction. Right.
So
even in the future, for example, for an egg and a genome to come together and interact and create something, it needs to have that womb, right? You can say,
well, what if they create that kind
uh-huh.
of artificial
so you can,
womb?
You can say you can have an artificial
yes.
womb. Then I could agree with you. And the process would take what? Let's say if a child is born within 9 months, so
mm-hmm.
the whole process of that child in this artificial womb will take a process of 9 months,
mm-hmm.
right? So this is even outside the womb, completely science fiction, in the near future could happen. I agree with you.
Okay.
In that movie, though, if you've seen it, how
yes.
was it? They bring a body,
mm-hmm.
like they have bodies made.
Yes.
They bring a body, then they insert something inside it. And then the body changes form as well
uh-huh.
as they're inserting the information inside it. Like
yes.
there's a machine that just, you know, sculptures the face
yeah.
and the body similar to the ones that's been copied.
Mm-hmm.
That's just not even
yeah.
science fiction.
Yeah, you're right. Sometimes
you know what I mean?
Scientifically speaking,
so
the clones don't need to be identical.
Exactly.
Right?
So we
yeah.
have a lot of science fiction movies about future and things happening.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, it's something you can digest because it is, at the end of the day, it's a
yeah.
movie for entertainment purposes
mm-hmm.
and it's science
right.
fiction.
Okay.
But this one is just... I don't know. I just couldn't digest it.
Okay. Thank
yeah.
you very much, Syed Abdullah. Let
yeah.
me stop you there for a short break, and then we'll be back. Back to the program Viewpoint on IRIB English Radio with me, Mohammed Javad, and our dear guest Sayyid Abdullah and Brother Hussein. Let me bring Brother Hussein in to the discussion. Do you have any comments on the first part of the program that we talked about, the cloning and the relationship between reality versus the kind of media portrait of cloning in this movie?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So the movie, when I first watched it, I found it to be very generic.
Mm-hmm.
Like Brother Abdullah said, it was something like science fiction. Mm-hmm. And I feel like because we are in the 21st century,
yes,
and this movie is over like 20 years old,
mm-hmm,
we've seen technology that is more advanced and, mm-hmm, more realistically, or scientifically applicable in this world. And that's why we believe, or we think, that this movie is not very accurate.
Yes.
They have bodies, like a blank canvas, and then you insert this disc, and it transforms quite magically,
mm-hmm,
into this being that you want. So I found it to be something like a dream, the movie. It's something that you can't really, understand fully, because there are a lot of hidden parts, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So, but frankly, I just found it boring.
I see. You know, what happens in many stories, novels, movies, which are based on those novels, like Jules Verne, for example.
Yeah.
There are lots of things that Jules Verne somehow foresaw that people of his time didn't understand, all right?
Mm-hmm.
And we see them coming into reality then, later, all right? So what do you think of that? Like, these kinds of movies, in fact, pump something, even if sounding unreal for the time being, but later they're going to be like a reality.
Yeah, well, of course, you can always predict the future, but in... it's always like a hit or miss situation. You can always predict the future, mm-hmm, using certain points from history,
mm-hmm,
yes, and kind of extrapolate how things are going to turn out later on. So I guess this is kind of what they did, but they didn't really hit. It was more of a miss, mm-hmm, in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, cloning is quite different now than what we see in the movie. We don't have empty bodies lying around inserting discs in them, so
that would be a surrogate instead of cloning, wouldn't it?
Mm.
It's like we have like surrogate movies,
yeah,
where
it's
they,
yeah,
just, another body takes control while there's somebody else controlling it, or
yes,
transferring. That would be a surrogate, wouldn't be a cloning though.
Mm.
Like, I don't know why they called it cloning to begin with.
I see.
So yeah, so it's like you said, it's not something that, even like you said, like in the future, right? In,
yeah,
the near future, even with these stories, it could possibly happen. For example, I wouldn't doubt in my mind, for example, if life goes on continuous, we could have a world like something like Star Wars.
Yes.
We could move to other planets and we could have this, a whole galaxy happening. It's possible.
Yeah,
But even from the director's perspective or the writer's perspective, it's something that can happen. So when you want to make a movie, even though it's futuristic and it could happen in the future, make it that it could be happen. It could happen.
Mm.
Like direct it or write it in a way where it could happen.
Yes.
For example, Minority Report with Tom Cruise,
yes,
which was released like in
2001, I guess.
2001, right? So, and I think they were the first to introduce the touch screen, where he, just going around touching things and,
yeah,
things moving the screens, right? And like was back for us back in the day, that was like amazing,
mm-hmm,
that you could touch a screen with your hand,
exactly,
and move things, right? Or like on a table. And now it became a reality, right?
Exactly.
Now we have all screens and you can do a lot of
all the smartphones are like that.
Exactly.
Like
so you can do a lot of magic with your hands now, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it did become a reality. So a lot of things, even though like you said, it's a hit and miss,
mm-hmm,
but this one is not even a matter of hit and miss. I think they might have had another agenda behind the whole movie rather than entertainment-wise, because like I said, entertainment-wise, it sucked.
Mm.
Yeah.
It's not something you could even waste your time watching it, right?
Yes.
As I'm like, and I don't know why they would, if Schwarzenegger wasn't in the movie, it would be a B-grade movie. It wouldn't even make it to the box office. because he was in the movie, it made it the box office.
Mm.
And it was like even they, you know, they
this
almost missed it in the box
office.
Like they spent $80 million on it, and they made 96.
Mm. You made $25 million.
Yeah, so it's only because he was in it.
Yeah.
If Schwarzenegger wasn't in it, this movie would not make it anywhere.
Yes, exactly.
So we have to see what was the idea of this whole movie they were trying to push.
Yes, barely moved. Made $96.1 million dollars. In fact, in the box office, you know. But
25.
They spent $82 million.
Yeah, so only $25 million.
The budget
that they made, like
yeah.
profit. And I'm telling you, the only reason they made that profit because of Schwarzenegger in it.
Yeah, exactly.
If it wasn't in it, it wouldn't even make it anywhere.
Mm, thank you very
that
much.
That's how stupid it was.
Thank you very much. Thank you guys for listening to us to the program Viewpoint on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad. Saying goodbye to you. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
About you. IRIB English Radio.
Round the world with reporters.
The fifth round of talks between Iran and the remaining signatories of the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA concludes in Vienna. The objective, to bring the U.S. back into the deal and to ensure the full implementation of Iran's nuclear commitments. EU coordinator Enrico Mora said the sticking points are fewer than they were a week ago.
It's a complex process with political decisions, with rather technical issues. They go in parallel. Now we are reaching a point in which we have to face the hard decisions. That's why it's only logical that head of delegations will go back to capitals. They will expose to their authorities the situation, and they will come back, I hope, with new, fresh ideas to finally close the negotiation.
Iranian lead delegate Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said although the sides have made good progress, some key issues still need to be resolved. Iran has demanded the removal of all sanctions imposed, reimposed, or relabeled under the former U.S. administration, saying it would only return to full compliance after the verification of sanctions removal.
It is certainly the other side who has to make difficult decisions. What we need to do at the same time is on the implementation plans, decide on the methods and ways which meet our interest most. But for the U.S., for the other side, for Europeans, it is time to make difficult decisions, and I hope that they would be able to do that.
The Joint Commission will meet again in a week's time, and though the EU coordinator said he is absolutely sure the next round will be the last, Iran's lead delegate opted for a more cautious stance, saying that nothing can be predicted in such difficult negotiations. Homolitsky, Vienna.
The European Commission reports that 45% of adults in the EU have now received their first dose of COVID-19 vaccine. In its latest budget policy recommendations under Economic Semester 2021, the Commission claims the vaccine rollout is providing hope.
Restrictions are being eased, and also more affected sectors are gradually again opening for business.
There is no official data available yet, but it is clear that right across the EU, businesses allowed to reopen in recent weeks simply have not. Government funding to support businesses while they were closed and financial support to keep jobs afloat is now being cut. This means the true scale of the economic crisis in the EU is very unclear at the moment. The bloc is on course, though, to vaccinate most adults before September the 1st. However, economists say that will not prove to be the proverbial silver bullet. Getting things back to how they were prior to COVID-19 will take years, they warn. Concern persists over the possibility that, as they emerge, new strains of COVID-19 might be resistant to existing vaccines.
Uncertainty is still high. We do not yet know what lasting effects the crisis will leave, and also the exact impact of the recovery and resilience facility.
Even before we get to learn about the real data in the coming months, things are already bad.
The youth unemployment rate remains more than double the average unemployment rate.
Experts say the EU needs to focus much more on creating quality jobs for young people.
The European Union definitely needs to continue working and invest more money on young people. This is definitely a crucial point. As you also said, we are the future of the population in Europe.
There is massive government and personal debt in the EU. The European Commission has announced it will not enforce austerity on the 27 member states until 2023. The question is, how will citizens be impacted when that does start happening again? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
After the Israeli airstrike hit Al-Kolak family building in the Gaza Strip, Zainab Al-Kolak was rescued by the civil defense after spending 12 hours under the rubble of her home. Zainab survived, but at least 30 members of her family were killed by the Israeli raid in the latest escalation against Gaza. After repeated failures to extricate her from the rubble, rescue workers finally saved Zainab Al-Kolak, a 22-year-old Palestinian woman who lost her family members in an Israeli airstrike on their house in the Gaza Strip.
We all gathered in a room watching news, and I was using my phone. We heard two missiles hitting somewhere really close. We heard bombing before, but this one was different, and the home was shaking. We got really scared, and we even forgot to take our bags of important things that we prepared for any possible bombing. My mom and my only sister were next to me. The last thing I remember was everyone scared and didn't know what was happening. The roof fell on our heads. In less than a second, I found myself under the rubble.
Stuck under the rubble, Zainab used her cell phone and called the Gaza ambulance service, hoping they could help her and save her family. But it took hours until they saved her from the rubble because Israeli regime destroyed the main roads leading to her home and the hospital.
I was holding my phone while trapped under the rubble. The voices of my mom and sister just disappeared, and I started to call people. I don't know how I remembered the numbers of civil defense. I called them, but they couldn't reach me. I started to call my friends, Shaima and Fatima, but I wasn't able to tell them I was under the rubble. I spent 12 hours there. I just imagined that when I called the civil defense, they would save us fast, but it took long to reach us, and eventually I lost the hope to stay alive.
Zainab, who studies English literature and is interested in arts, expressed that no words can describe her feeling of losing her family. While Zainab's father is still at hospital receiving treatment, Zainab is now worried about her new burdens and responsibilities after losing her mother.
This is not the first time Israel has done such a massacre. We lived our lives just between one war and another. We thought we were safe, but no one is. They hit us with no prior notice. We were a big family, and now I can count us on one hand. I used to be a normal student, and now I have millions of things to take care of as life throws me in the middle of everything.
Zainab and her family members are not the only victims of the Israeli attacks. 11 days of Israeli air, land, and sea assaults on Gaza killed 255 Palestinians, including 66 children.
The strikes also wounded more than 1,900 people before a ceasefire went into effect on May the 21st. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
The International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA's latest report on Iran is the first since the country stopped implementing voluntary transparency measures as a result of a law passed by Parliament restricting agency access to nuclear facilities. Under a temporary agreement between Tehran and the IAEA valid until the 24th of June, the agency will continue to collect data at Iran's key nuclear facilities via its surveillance equipment, but will not be able to access that data. Iran's envoy to the IAEA, Kazem Gharibabadi, said the agency had no access that had previously been provided under the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA.
The verification and monitoring activities that the agency had in our nuclear facilities based on the JCPOA, as the Director General reflected in his report, actually all those areas have been stopped and the agency didn't have any kind of access in accordance with the JCPOA to our nuclear sites and also the nuclear activities in the nuclear facilities.
In his report, IAEA Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi estimated Iran's stockpile of enriched uranium to be about 16 times higher than the limit set in the deal. Gharibabadi said Iran is continuing to enrich uranium at the level of 5, 20 and 60%. The limit set in the deal was 3.67%.
There is no suspension in the nuclear activities, such as installation of production, installation of new machines, and also the enrichment level and the stockpile. So it is very important that actually these kind of activities have not been affected even due to the nuclear negotiation that we have around the JCPOA in Vienna nowadays.
Iran stepped back from its nuclear commitments in response to the previous U.S. administration's withdrawal from the deal and the reimposition of sanctions.
Negotiations to revive the deal have been taking place in Vienna since April, with Tehran standing firm on its position. It will only return to full compliance after the U.S. has removed all sanctions in a verifiable manner. Homa Lizgi, Vienna.
After months of despair and a battle against the COVID-19 pandemic, a ray of hope has emerged in several parts of Indian subcontinent as the second wave of the pandemic is showing signs of retreat. The new cases continue to fall for the fourth consecutive day, based on government figures. Health experts and surveys, however, suggest the figures could be 20 times higher than the official figures.
We were overwhelmed by the daily number of cremations till last week, and most of the time there was hardly any calculation. Now it seems there is a slight drop in cases. I hope things are changing now. We pray to God we never get to see such scenes again.
According to a latest study carried out by scientists at the University of Michigan, along with scholars from several institutes, the estimated COVID cases in India could be as high as 492 million till mid-May, which contradicts the Indian official figures of 24 million. The study also puts the overall death toll 4.5 times more than what is officially recorded.
We were struggling last week with the number of patients and dead bodies, and I'm sure there is no proper data about the number of deaths since India is a big country. Cities might have calculations, but there is no calculation about villages.
Many parts of the country have now started gradually opening after weeks of strict lockdowns, which has put a tremendous toll on the country's economic activity. Officials, however, have warned the pandemic is not over, urging people to follow the COVID protocol strictly. Lockdowns aimed at containing the pandemic have now inflicted a heavy toll on the country's economy. Reports suggest the South Asian nation could be headed for a double-digit unemployment rate in the coming weeks, and migrant workers are among the hardest hit. According to official figures, India has registered 28 million COVID cases so far, 25 million have recovered, and about 330,000 have died due to the pandemic. Now the country is battling acute vaccination shortage, while it aims to vaccinate 10 million adults per day from mid-July. biggest vaccine makers have already started bidding for the contracts after states were directed to buy vaccines directly from the manufacturers. Health experts say it is a mammoth task given the country's geography and the population. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
The UK Armed Forces' allure for far-right extremists is believed to be as old as British fascism's earliest incarnations. At least 16 members of the country's armed forces investigated over the past 2.5 years have been referred to the UK's so-called PREVENT scheme, a controversial terrorism prevention program.
The British Army is seen as being a defence of Britain and British values, but those British values are rooted in racism, as I say, and also in its history of colonialism and empire. The British military is in itself a racist institution because Britain is a racist society.
The UK Ministry of Defence is yet to release exact figures, but it says the number of investigations in 2020 was less than 10, and those so far this year, less than 5. Critics say, despite the MOD's stated commitment to zero tolerance for far-right extremists operating within the armed forces, its strong words have not always led to strong action.
Of course the British government is going to say there is a zero tolerance policy, but that is nothing in keeping with the reality when it comes to the culture that exists within the British Army. Because of its role, because of its history, because of its legacy, and because of its identity. The far right is on the march, not just in the UK, but throughout the West. This is a result of the socio-economic problems ushered in by the 2008 economic collapse, and the far right have been able to point the fingers at migrants and refugees and existing minority communities as being the problem. I think that this is just the tip of the iceberg. I think it goes far, far deeper, and I think there's a cover-up abroad in consequence.
Of the 14 investigations carried out in 2019 into serving armed forces personnel, a staggering 11 stemmed from far-right concerns. And those concerns have been fueled by images such as this one from 2019. British paratroopers using pictures of former Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn for target practice.
Last year, the UK's top counter-terrorism officer said the fastest-growing UK terrorist threat came from the far right. A year later, the threat is still there, with critics saying the government is not taking the threat seriously enough. Saeed Bourizza, London.
The IRIB, the Broadcasting Organization of Iran. The red carpet treatment is being given to the candidates who want to contest in 13th presidential election. Several studios are hosting the seven runners who explain in detail their plans.
The economy under my administration will focus on domestic production and exports. Whatever creates obstacles on that path has to be removed, and whatever strengthens that sector must be paid attention to and boosted. One of my administration's approaches will be to use a strong foreign policy to create international markets to improve our domestic production and exports. We can make the best of the demands in countries in South America, Africa, and South Asia to achieve that end.
Zakani stressed that the next administration has to change course and rely on Iran's domestic capabilities and utilize all regional and international capacities to move towards success. The other candidate, Saeed Jalili, said Iran must not await favors from those who murdered Iranian anti-terror commander Qasem Soleimani. He also added that a wrong approach and a weak performance cannot take the country to the summits. Mohsen Rezaei also took the floor to talk to the people regarding his economic agenda.
Some people misunderstood my plans about boosting the national currency. I said we can increase the value of our currency to become the third strongest money in the region after the US dollar and euro. It means that when you go to the exchange market after the first two, Iran's rial would be exchanged the most.
Rezaei also called for reforms in Iran's insurance, banking, and stock market systems. Reformist Mohsen Mehralizadeh, who was speaking at a news network, said that the main problems of the country today are due to macro policies, and the world-known scientific models should be used to solve the problems. In the end, Mehralizadeh referred to economic problems of people, but asked them to go to the polls to use the right of democracy to solve such issues.
Some 60 million Iranians are eligible to vote in the 13th presidential election, which is slated to be held on June 18th. Uman Abedi,